This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Academic Life. This is the podcast for your academic journey and beyond. I'm the show creator and show host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today I'm joined by Dr. Helen Sword, the author of Stylish Academic Writing. Welcome to the show, Helen.
Thank you, Christina.
I am so glad you're here and that we get to learn from you about stylish academic writing. The title drew me in immediately as something we all need to know more about. Before we dive into that, though, will you please tell us about yourself?
Sure. I grew up in Southern California and went off to eventually to Princeton University to do my PhD in comparative literature. So I started as a literary scholar my scholarly life, a poet and a reader and critic and teacher of poetry. That was always my first great love. And I went from there to the English department at Indiana University, taught literature for a decade or more. And then in the early 2000s, my husband and I decided to move to New Zealand, which is where my husband's from. We had been talking about it for years. We had three kids at that point, and the oldest was 10 years old. So we just felt like if we were ever going to do it, we needed to do it. So we took the plunge. We moved to New Zealand with our three kids and all our earthly possessions and no jobs. So yes, I left behind tenure. People are always amazed to hear that, at a really great university, great department, a job that I loved. But I went off in search of this new adventure and had to be willing to take a different kind of job, not to just be a literary scholar anymore. So I ended up at the University of Auckland, which is New Zealand's biggest university, and was there for 17 years, working first in academic development, so kind of teaching the teachers. And that got me interested in looking at teaching and, I guess, communication across the disciplines, across the academic disciplines. So it really was the first time that I stepped up out of my literary studies silo and started talking to people in other disciplines about the work that they did, scientists and architects and business scholars and social scientists, all kinds of people whose work I hadn't really read or known much about. I discovered, much to my shock, that they did not believe, as I did, that the English department was the center of the academic universe. Sometimes they thought that, you know, their lab that was trying to cure cancer was maybe more important. So that was a great eye-opener for me. But I also just loved it. I loved working with people from across the disciplines. And at the same time, I was teaching in the English department at the university, just one course a year. So I had a way to try out teaching innovations that I was talking to people about. But bit by bit, I started to kind of bring my interest in writing into the mix. And I started to realize that all the things that were interesting about the different ways that people in various disciplines think and teach were also being expressed through the different ways that they write. And I think this became clear to me, especially when I started researching and trying to publish myself in higher education research. so different from literary studies. Everything about it, I had to sort of unlearn and relearn. But more than anything, I was really shocked by how terrible some of the writing was. And I try to be mostly really positive about writing and not to be judgmental and negative. But sometimes you just read things where you go, I cannot believe this is published. And I can't believe somebody thought that this is the best way to communicate. So think about it. Here are these people who are doing research on higher education, teaching and learning. So they're finding out how do students learn? How can we most effectively teach them whatever our subject area? And then they were writing these articles that seemed to be designed to be unreadable by any of the people who might most benefit from the research. So that was really where it all started with stylish academic writing. I started thinking, why is it like this? But more to the point, how can we change? How can people be empowered to write differently? And I think I did see pretty early on that most academics are not writing in an unclear, arcane, jargony style because they want to put off their readers. They're doing it because they think they have to. They've somehow been taught or told along the way, often in graduate school, sometimes before, that this is the only way to be accepted or respected in your discipline. So I set out to first investigate and then dismantle what I came to see as a whole series of myths about how academics communicate and how we should and how we're allowed to. I found that a lot of people were weighed down by conventions that they perceived as laws. So that's really how stylish academic writing came about. And I probably never would have written it if I just stayed teaching poetry in an English department.
One of the things you say in the book is that as academics, we distrust style and readability. And that really resonated with me. While I don't distrust style and readability, I had that as feedback as early as undergrad, that the clearer it was, the more direct it was, the more I could drill down what it was about, the less seriously I was going to be taken.
Who do you get that feedback from?
One of my history professors.
Yeah, it's so sad and surprising in that context, because having looked at writing in all different disciplines and having a pretty good sense of what the norms and conventions are, I would say if I had to pick a discipline that really privileges and teaches and admires clear writing, it would be historians. Literary scholars like me don't expect to be read by the general public, so they very easily move into this more jargony style where you're sort of talking amongst yourselves and making lots of in-jokes and puns and references to other texts, which can be quite a fun game, but it's an insider's game. But almost every historian I've ever met, and I've interviewed a lot of academic writers about their work, they tend to tell me that they want to, of course, impress their peers, but really their great dream is to write the book that will be read by, you know, their next-door neighbor or the parent on their kid's soccer team, and that person will come up and say, I loved your book. So I'm a little shocked that you were told that by a history professor, but we get these messages in all kinds of different ways, and sometimes we're told them explicitly, and sometimes it's more just implicit, and sometimes we just learn through imitation. So cultural historians will talk about, you know, how do we learn, right? As human beings born into a culture, well, mostly you learn by looking around you and doing what other people do. If you're in a culture where people eat with a knife and fork, you pretty quickly learn to do that. If you're in a culture where people eat with chopsticks or with their hands, you learn to do that. And it's only if you actually move to that other culture that you might even question what your culture does and go, oh, yeah, why do we use a knife and forks? It's so much easier with my hands, or whatever else. But when we're within the dominant culture, it's very difficult to change the only way we learn to do things other than that sort of received way of doing things, the cultural norm, is if we have some kind of impetus to actually shift out of that, because it's hard to do that, and it's scary, and it sometimes feels a bit dangerous. And one of the ways we learn that is through education, right? You read a bunch of stuff that challenges the received norms, and then you start to think, oh, there are other ways to do this. What I grew up with is not the only way. But one of the issues I found with academic writing, and this really came more from my next book, where I interviewed a lot of people about how they learned to write in their disciplines and how they developed this sense of the norms, is most academics whom I interviewed, so these were mostly faculty and postdocs, some PhD students, but mostly people who are already very much in an academic career. And the most common answer they gave me when I asked how they learned to write in their discipline was, I didn't, or sink or swim. So if you think about it for yourself, and I'm talking to everybody out there, if I asked you, how did you actually learn to be an academic writer in whatever discipline you're in, you may well have taken some research methodology courses along the way. But most academics have never really taken a course that is just focused on what is high-level academic writing. Why do we do things the way we do them? What do other disciplines do? You know, that kind of examining of our norms. So to go back to your story, Christina, you know, I think sometimes having just one person tell you something when you're at a formative stage, because you're not in a position to really examine that or to be looking at other viewpoints, you just kind of accept it and in some cases internalize it. You know, I've interviewed people who have said that, you know, they were told by their high school teacher that they would never be a good writer. And they just, that's what they carried around for them for years and years, sometimes well beyond getting a PhD and publishing a few books. And they still have this little voice of their teacher in their head saying, you're just not going to be a good writer. So, yeah, we pick those things up. I think two of the most common things that people seem to believe, one is that they're supposed to use jargon or more complex language, and if they don't, they won't be taken seriously. And the other, in some disciplines, is that they're not allowed to use first-person pronouns. So I get that a lot. I would look at a discipline. I would look at the journals in the discipline and find out that, I don't know, 70 or 80% of the people use I or we, the published authors. And then I would go to talk to people in that same discipline, and they would assure me fervently that they were absolutely not allowed to use first-person pronouns. It just wasn't done. You know? So sometimes the evidence doesn't match what we've somehow absorbed or come to believe. And that's what I call a lot of those beliefs myths. And I don't mean that as disparaging to the people who believe those myths, because they've been imposed on us somehow by the culture. But what hasn't happened then is for us to have an opportunity to really question and examine them, which is why I wrote this book.
You mentioned jargon a moment ago, and it is often our shield of respectability in our field. It can signal that we know our stuff. But you cautioned us about jargonitis, and chapter 10 really goes into jargonitis, and it gives us some actionable tools for how we can really interrogate how we're using it and if it needs to be there. Can you talk to us about what to do if we are using jargon too much?
Yeah, well, I might just read you the first paragraph of that chapter. I've got it sitting right here, because I think it kind of speaks to what you're saying. Every discipline has its own specialized language, its membership rights, its secret handshake. I remember the moment when, as a PhD student in comparative literature, I casually dropped the phrase psychosexual morphology into a discussion of a Thomas Hardy novel. What power! From the professor's approving nod and the envious shuffling of my fellow students around the seminar table, I knew that I had just flashed the golden badge that admitted me into an elite disciplinary community. Needless to say, my new party trick fell flat on my non-academic friends and relations. Whenever I solemnly intoned the word Foucauldian, they quickly went off to find another beer. So the first place to start is by asking ourselves, why am I using these words and phrases? And often it feels quite good, you know, it's fun. I certainly found that with literary jargon, that as a PhD student, as I became adept with it, it was like learning a new language and having this wonderful power. And I often think of it when you watch like medical TV shows, you know, the sort of ER type shows where the doctors are all shouting these medical terms at each other because that's their shorthand, right? It's shorthand for the people in the discipline, but for everybody else, it's this kind of like, ooh, look, they're so amazing. They know this language we don't know. So the first step there is to ask, am I using this word or this phrase? And we could take away the word jargon. We could just call it technical language, right? So that it's not as pejorative. I want to use this technical word that other people in my discipline will understand, or some will, but maybe some won't. Why am I using it? Do I need to use it? Should I be explaining it or contextualizing it? Not necessarily a long explanation if most people know it, but often we can just add a phrase that brings in the readers who don't know it. And then, of course, do we need to be using it at all, or would simpler language do? And an example I had in my book was, in fact, that word Foucauldian, right? Meaning having to do with the writings or beliefs or theories of the French cultural theorist Michel Foucault. I did an analysis of the word Foucauldian in my kind of data sample, which was 1,000 articles from across different disciplines, and just looked for how many of them used the word Foucauldian. It popped up mainly in literary studies and history and education, interestingly, higher education. And then I looked at how those specific authors used the word, and I found that most of them were using it, in fact, as jargon, that where the reader then was supposed to first of all go, oh, I'm so impressed they use the word Foucauldian. But then I was also supposed to know enough to say, oh, Foucauldian means having to do with cultural power issues. That's how it's often used as shorthand. I discovered that most of the people who quoted it were not actually quoting from primary texts by Foucault. They were mostly quoting from other people's writings about Foucault. So it was already a kind of second or third hand use of this idea. And I think pretty much in all but one case where the person actually was engaging with the writings of Foucault directly, all of the others could have used a different word or found a different way of saying things, but did seem to be dropping it in there kind of more to, again, I don't want to sound too pejorative, but more to show off than anything else, to get that little thrill of their own power over a reader who either is in the in club or possibly feels like they're not smart enough for it. So back to your question, how do we kind of dismantle that? How do we do less of it? Question ourselves, but then also turn things around and think about our reader. Who is our reader? who could our reader be if we didn't use this word? And again, back to that why am I using it? So Marjorie Garber, a literary critic whom I quote in the book, she talks about jargon as being like a computer macro. So computer macro is when you develop like one keystroke, you know, Alt D or something that will kind of launch a series of little, it will make several things happen. So it's a shortcut, basically. And so if you think of jargon as a shortcut, if I'm talking to a whole bunch of people who have read Foucault, and that those are the only people in the room, and I use the word Foucauldian in a way that everybody's going to understand, it just saves me about a paragraph of explaining what does he believe and all this other stuff. But the danger with that shorthand, of course, is all the people you're leaving out. So I often, in writing workshops, I encourage people to write a list of five real people in the world. So actual names of people. So starting with somebody in their discipline that they'd really like to impress, you know, somebody, some famous author that, you know, they could imagine reading their paper and wanting them to nod and say, oh, yes, they're so intelligent. The next person would be what I call a critical friend in your discipline. So that would be someone whom you maybe you went to grad school with, or you know, somebody who works in the same field whom you can trust to give you honest, supportive feedback. So the friend who will say, you know, this is really interesting paper, Christina, but this paragraph here, I feel like you're using all these big words, but I don't quite understand what your main point is, right? So different from a peer reviewer who's just trying to chop you down. They're actually trying to build you up. And then the third person would be a critical friend outside of your discipline. So that would be somebody who's not a specialist, whom you could show your paper, a chapter, or a thesis to, who would give you that same kind of supportive but honest feedback. So you see, as we move away from the specialization, we might need to write a bit differently for that person, with that person in mind. And the fourth person I encourage people to think about is an advanced undergraduate or beginning graduate student in their discipline. And so that would be somebody who's interested enough to be reading a specialized article or book, but who you wouldn't want to be putting off. You'd want to be pulling them in. So for them, you'd be thinking, well, am I contextualizing? If I am using this jargon word, am I doing it in a way that will bring them into the conversation rather than make them think that they don't belong? And then the fifth person I always encourage people to write down is what I call Aunt Mabel and Uncle Bob. Basically, it's the relative who's not an academic or doesn't do the kind of writing you do, or your bus driver, or the nice lady at the cafe who rings up your coffee order every day. Somebody who you could imagine having a conversation with about your work, about your research, whatever you're doing. But if you did, you would need to couch it in layman's terms. You wouldn't be able to use that disciplinary jargon at all. And then the point I would make with those five names, and you might want to write them down and just keep them by your computer, in any given sentence, you can say, you know, which of these people is this going to resonate with? Who here can understand this? The thing is, with academic writing, you are very seldom going to be writing things that are really aimed at all five of those people simultaneously. You're going to have to choose where you're aiming. I like to aim for that advanced undergraduate and the critical friend outside the discipline. So for the intelligent, interested, reasonably educated reader who maybe doesn't know all the jargon in my discipline and probably doesn't want to know it, I think if you aim for that aspirational reader, that high-end reader, you can just end up hearing that voice. You know, you'll hear that voice of your history professor saying, oh, this is too simple. You know, you need to make this more complex to show how smart you are. And likewise, the critical friend in your disciplines, great person to have on board, but they may not see, they may not recognize the points where you're using the jargon. Whereas the person outside the discipline will let you know immediately. And I would hope that we would all want that advanced undergraduate to read our work and be drawn in to the discipline rather than put off. But Aunt Mabel and Uncle Bob have their place too, because sometimes you do need to explain the work you're doing to a non-academic audience. And knowing how to do that, having the phrasing, having the kind of big picture language without any jargon at all, is really important and valuable for those times. So, you know, it's really when you turn things around and think about your audience rather than about your own kind of virtuosity in the subject, that resolves the question pretty quickly of how complex should this be? Should I use this word?
And for listeners, that list is on page 46. And one of the questions that you guide us through with that list is to keep asking ourselves, how far into this work can each one of these people read? And I really appreciated that guiding question, because you can imagine the different readers dropping out at different points as they're reading, because at some point it becomes such a siloed way of writing if we're not mindful of the different people who may really genuinely want to engage with our work.
Absolutely, yeah. And sometimes it's the title. The title is already the first piece of barbed wire. And if you're writing in a really specialist area, that just may be how it is. I mean, my son's doing a PhD in artificial intelligence and machine learning from a very kind of mathematical neural networking perspective. And I don't even understand his titles. But I would like him to be able to write a paragraph for me that it does explain in terms that I can understand what he's doing. If he can't do that, he'll struggle moving forward. If he goes into an academic career, he'll struggle with things like grant proposals that might go for to readers outside of the specialized discipline. He might struggle if he's trying to get a job or an academic promotion or trying to teach a concept to undergraduates. So having the ability to speak those different kind of levels of language within your discipline, that's really important.
The book is divided into parts. Part one is style and substance. Part two is the elements of stylishness. And chapter six is tempting titles. So since we're talking about titles and how to communicate with the potential audience what it is that we might be writing about, what makes a tempting title?
It's one of my favorite chapters, really. I still go back to it a lot. And when I'm running workshops and things, I could happily spend all day talking with people about their titles. What I did for that chapter was I went into my data set, which again was 1,000 articles drawn from 10 different disciplines across the humanities, social sciences, and sciences. And I just analyzed them. I just looked at them and went, what are these titles doing? How are they structured? What's out there, basically? And then what I wanted to get to was the shift from what's out there to what are some good principles to follow when you're coming up with a title. So what I found was that all of the titles basically fell into one of three categories. So there were the titles that were purely descriptive, sometimes hard to understand, but they were trying to be purely descriptive. You know, an analysis of the frequency of the blah, 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 blah. There were the ones that were purely catchy. And so you didn't quite know what they were about, but they caught your eye. I don't know, rocks in a jar or something. You know, he might not know where the hot rocks, there was one in geology about, volcanic rocks. Now, it had a subtitle as well that then explained what the article was really about. So that's the third category, which is what I call the catchy and descriptive or engaging and informative title. And I would have said that most academic writers, most of the time, it's a good idea to aim for engaging and informative. If it's purely informative, it can be really long and boring, and your reader's going to know immediately that the entire article's probably going to be in that mode. But if it's purely catchy, people don't know what it's about, and we do need a certain number of keywords for search engines and all that kind of stuff too, although you can put the keywords as well in the abstract. So I analyze these various titles to show what makes for a catchy title, what makes for an informative but not overly long and jargon-ridden title, and how do you put them together? So the standard way to put them together is with a colon, catchy, colon, informative. And those can be a little long and maybe a little cliched, you know, hot rocks, a study of volcanic, blah, blah, blah. But they do the job because they're both drawing you in and telling you what it's about. So there's nothing wrong with writing that kind of title if it suits your discipline. The ones I would discourage people from writing are the ones that have a colon, but it's just long, informative, and boring, colon, long, informative, and boring. So it's just this incredibly long title, but it's the colon's not doing anything to help make it catchier. The ones I always try for are catchy and informative with a colon, but without a colon, but it's incredibly hard. I think I got there with stylish academic writing because stylish and academic are two words we don't usually see together. In fact, some people would say that's an oxymoron. So as soon as you see those together, you go, hang on, how can something academic be stylish? I think I'll read this book and find out. And I don't think a subtitle would really have given any additional information. My example in the book, I think of one of my favorite titles ever, is the movie called Snakes on a Plane. You don't need to know anything more than what the title already tells you. But of course, movies have somewhat different ways of working than academic articles, where we do need to let people know what they're about.
Chapter 3, you look at the style guides. And you invite us to interrogate what's holding us back on our own use of style. And one of the things that you point out is most of us aren't really taught how to write for our discipline. And as we try to figure out how we're going to tackle something, we rely on a few key things. We rely on our memory of what we were told by our professors. We rely on peer reviews, and we rely on reading journals. All of those things can kind of reinforce a bubble that the title is supposed to be really, really long, and we are supposed to use really complicated sentences, and we are supposed to continually, you know, signal to our silo that this is for them. And you invite us to consider where a lot of these quote-unquote style ideas come from. One of the interesting things that you point out is there's an anthropologist, Ruth Behar, who makes a case for vulnerability and how so many of us have been taught through these methods, is what our memory is telling us we were told we were supposed to avoid, that so many of us were taught we are not supposed to have vulnerability in our writing.
Yeah, so, a lot of this comes down to individual experience too. That's what's interesting. It's not as though there's this one uniform concept in the discipline of anthropology of what the writing can look like. Now, Ruth Behar, when she was writing her book about the vulnerable observer, she was terrified when she first presented it as conference paper because it was so out there in terms of what the discipline expected. And she had all these people coming up to her and writing to her and saying, thank you, thank you. And it turned out that she was one of those people who sort of helped turn the tide, helped empower people in that discipline to write differently. And what I found writing this book, and the book is from 2012, so a fair amount of water has passed under the bridge since then, and yet pretty much everything in it is still true, certainly. But I found that in just about every discipline I looked at, there were exemplars of what I call stylish academic writing. And I should say, if you don't like the word stylish, if that doesn't resonate with you, you can just replace it with engaging. Engaging academic writing, writing that is trying to pull your reader in. That's what I'm talking about. There are examples in just about every discipline. And so the question is, why do we feel like we have to follow the examples of the writing that doesn't engage us when there are these other examples out there? And there are many answers to that. One might be that they're just such a minority, we haven't even read them. One might be that they seem to be written mainly by people who are farther ahead in their careers, who are established, who have tenure. And so we associate that kind of ability to write in a more engaging way, or maybe in a more vulnerable way, with power, in a sense, with seniority and power. And I've heard people say this to me very explicitly, you know, I'm not allowed to write like that now, I have to get tenure first, that sort of thing. Which is interesting, when I interviewed people for my book, Aaron Light and Time and Space, which is about how successful academics write, and I interviewed people and asked, one of the questions I asked was, you know, you're a stylish writer. Is this true that you had to wait until you had tenure, you were more established, or have you been like that from the beginning? And I got a mix of answers. I got some people who said, basically, you know, you have to learn your scales and learn your Beethoven before you can be John Cage and play with more radical things, you know. So you have to show, you have to prove yourself first. But then I had several other people who said, you know, you're not going to magically change one day when you get tenure if you've spent years and years and years tamping down all sense of style and energy and engagement. If you've been following the rules for all the years up till then, what makes you think you're going to suddenly turn into somebody who pushes against conventions? So I guess my own feeling is that it's, and when I advise early career academics, generally for PhD students, my advice is get the PhD. And sometimes if that means kind of giving in to things that your supervisor or committee wants that go against the grain for you, if that's something that's going to cost you a month or two of your life to write that, make that chapter boring rather than interesting, but it's going to mean you're going to have a lifetime then with a PhD, then just go for it. But beyond that point, I really do believe in going with your gut, in not being afraid to push against the boundaries, against the conventions. And what I found from my interviews, unsurprisingly, is that the people who do that kind of work often end up at the top of their fields because they are then seen as the pathbreakers. Ruth Behar is a great example of that. You know, she was an untenured assistant professor when she was first starting to write about the vulnerable observer, and now she's highly acclaimed in her field, won lots of prizes and things, because she went with her gut. But having said all that, you know, that's a scary place to be, especially when you're first starting out. So you need to buttress it with lots of examples and evidence. So that's where my book, you know, I tried to assemble a lot of evidence, first of all, in that chapter 3 that you're talking about, that most of the style guides are not telling you the stuff that people somehow believe. So I couldn't find any style guides that said, oh, I'll pile on the jargon, that's what you should be doing. I couldn't find any style guides in any discipline that said, oh, it's better to write in the passive voice than the active voice, or you should never use first-person pronouns. There certainly are style guides that will explain when you can and maybe even should use passive voice over active voice when you're writing, because that's a question of judgment and of control as a writer. So it's not saying you have to do one or you have to do the other. The more you understand about the conventions of your discipline, but also the outliers, the possibilities, the more you understand about how certain kinds of writing engage readers and other kinds of writing put them off. All of those things help empower you then to, not give in, to not feel that you have to choose the lowest common denominator in terms of writing style. You can aim to be like the best writers, not like the worst. And this will actually help you rather than hinder you in your academic career.
All of the chapters have tips at the end that you can play with and try to engage with your writing from different angles. You encourage people to write with passion, with courage, with craft, and with style. You encourage them to focus on communication and creativity. And if people don't know how to do that, you give them lots of different types of writing exercises they can do. Towards the end of the book, on page 170 and 171, there's some great places for getting started. One is you suggest people use free writing. Many of us use free writing when we teach, and it makes students nervous because I'm getting the sense that free writing is often maybe poorly explained. So can you explain how free writing really frees people up and what it's intended to do?
Absolutely. And I write a lot about this in my subsequent books as well on productivity, and my most recent book's called Writing with Pleasure, which is kind of going back to these same things we're talking about, ways in which maybe as academics we believe that if we're bringing pleasure to our writing process, something's wrong. Whereas what I found in my research and my interviews is that it's precisely by bringing pleasure to the process that we become more productive. So there's a lot of, and likewise, as we think about being stylish writers, we become more successful rather than less successful, all those sorts of things. But free writing is just such a powerful tool. And I think I maybe had an advantage as a literary scholar that I always saw, I can't remember whether I was explicitly taught it or just picked it up, but I always understood that writing is thinking. That while I am writing, new ideas are formulating in my brain in a different way than when I'm just thinking or talking about something. That the act of writing is in itself generative. And since writing Stylish Academic Writing, I've learned a lot more about the ways in which writing by hand, in particular, is generative in a different kind of way than writing by computer. Writing by computer can be generative as well, but we touch type, most of us, more quickly than we handwrite. And so writing by hand slows us down in a beneficial way, and it connects us more to the material world, to the physicality of writing, and to, I think, the pleasure of writing for a lot of people. It kind of takes them back to times in their life when writing was pleasurable. So it's a great thing to do for many reasons. But what free writing itself does then is it just gives you a space where you're writing about what you're thinking about or in response to a prompt or however you want to do it. You could just write by hand in a notebook for 10 minutes before you start doing your more kind of formal academic writing every day. know, there's lots of different techniques, but what it does is it kind of frees up a flow in your brain of ideas. And sometimes you end up capturing a few things. If I get stuck when I'm explaining something and I just can feel those ponderous abstract nouns, what I call the zombie nouns, kind of coming in and taking over, and I can feel the sentences getting longer, and I'll just stop and go, okay, what is it that I'm trying to say? I'm going to free write for 10 minutes and pretend I'm explaining this to a 12-year-old or to Aunt Mabel and Uncle Bob or whatever. And I'll just give myself those 10 minutes to write. Now, I'm not expecting the results of that free writing to then go verbatim into my manuscript. And that's really the key thing. I think as academics, we think that if we're not writing something that will be publishable, maybe with some revisions, but basically if we're not working on our draft, we are wasting our time. And free writing actually says, let's step away from the draft and do some writing that is just a form of thinking. So if none of the words from your draft make it back in, none of the words from your free writing make it into your draft, it is still a valuable exercise if it's unlocked a new way of thinking about the structure maybe of your paper, or a different way of thinking about who your audience is or what your main idea is. But sometimes you may find if your task for yourself is to explain something clearly, you may actually have some sentences where you go, oh yeah, okay. I don't know why that was so hard, but I'm going to type that up now and put it into my draft. And I also, it's not just free writing, free drawing, mind mapping. I love doing anything that involves bringing in some spatial elements. I'll do things often with post-it notes, kind of whiteboarding things. I think a lot through color. So I'll often assign different colors to different ideas that I'm grappling with, and then I'll put them all on different colored post-it notes and move them around. And that will help me see what I'm working on in a different way. And then I can go back to that more linear manuscript just with some new ways of thinking about it. It sort of unlocks our creativity and our pleasure, but also our more kind of natural eloquence and style, which is there, and which I think a lot of those academic habits have made us unlearn.
We're starting to run out of time. There are so many wonderful tips in the book that I wish we had time to dig into now. What do you hope listeners will take away?
I think the most valuable advice I could give to somebody who wants to write more stylishly is to find examples of writing that you admire in your discipline, ideally, but it doesn't have to be. And it can also be things like a really great piece of journalism. It doesn't necessarily have to be academic writing, but probably nonfiction writing that you can learn from. Stop, keep it, put it in a file. And at some point, go and spend even just 5-10 minutes. Actually, it's great free writing type exercise, and just analyze it. Steven Pinker, who wrote a wonderful book called The Sense of Style, he talks about reverse engineering or lingering over good prose. So you go to, you take your paragraph by Ruth Behar, if you're an anthropologist or whatever, and you don't just say, oh, Ruth Behar says I should be more vulnerable. You go, okay, what's she doing in this paragraph? And then see if you could find one thing that author is doing that you could try. Maybe they're using a concrete example. Maybe they're starting with an anecdote rather than this sort of ponderous abstract opening. Maybe there's something about the pace of their sentences. You've noticed these three short sentences followed by one very long one. You go, oh, maybe I'll just try that and see what happens. That becomes a very safe way of experimenting with style moving forward, because you can usually do just one thing, one more interesting title just one thing and see if the sky falls. And most often, not only does the sky not fall, but you're going to have people praising you and saying, oh, I really liked that article. So this is what I've tried to do in the book. I've taken examples of fantastic writing from all different disciplines that people sent to me, recommended to me. And throughout the book, I've reverse engineered them. So if you're reading the chapter on pronouns, I'm showing you how other authors use pronouns. And if you're reading the chapter on jargon, I'm showing you, well, probably some egregious examples of jargon, but also ways that some authors have managed to use a technical word, for example, in a way that makes it easier to understand rather than a barrier to understanding. So exemplars, and then just taking the time, because we're always rushing forward. But Stephen Covey, who wrote The 7 Habits of Highly Successful People, he uses this phrase, sharpening the saw, a story about somebody trying to chop down a tree with a dull saw. And someone else comes along and says, well, why don't you sharpen the saw? And they say, oh, I don't have time. You know, so we're always so busy writing that we think that we don't have time to sharpen the saw of our writing. But even just doing that one bit of reverse engineering something yourself and applying it, that's sharpening the saw. Taking a book like Stylish Academic Writing and choosing one chapter to read and try one of the exercises at the end, that's sharpening the saw. Finding online resources. I've got a whole community called The Write Space that people can join. There are many others. Just taking one thing, maybe once a week, where you're going to devote 20 minutes of your busy week to sharpening the saw and not just moving forward with the status quo. And bit by bit, incrementally, your writing will become more stylish, more engaging. People will notice. You'll enjoy it more. You'll get more pleasure from it. And you'll feel more empowered as a writer who's writing about something you care about, something you're passionate about. It's a wonderful thing to feel like that sense of energy and passion is reaching your reader as well.
Dr. Helen Sword, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing from your book, Stylish Academic Writing. This is The Academic Life. Please join us again.